So what if you can't touch the sky? It doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Do you wanna fly?
Ladies and gents, it's that time again. Another episode of the High Times miniseries, where today we speak to Judith A. Williams. Judith played Claire in High Times, and today we're going to catch up with her and see what her life's like, you know, after High Times and where she is in her career. She is an incredible jazz singer, and she's a very artsy kind of person. What rhymes with artsy is fartsy, and speaking of fartsy, J-Mac is on the show.
Well, that's the best way I've ever been introduced to anything. Thank you very much. I've not pumped in at least 2 minutes. That's what you call a bum note.
Brilliant.
A little reference to High Times. It was an absolute pleasure to speak to Judith. She gave us a good hour of her time, and really interesting conversation. She's just got a lot of opinions on things, and it was really, really good to get to know her a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It was good. It was good speaking to Judith. It's nice to speak to my significant other where it comes to metaphors. I felt like for the first time on this podcast, I felt like I could speak to someone metaphorically. I'm reminded that
I've never heard so many metaphors in one conversation. It's actually something to behold. In fact, let's have a drinking game with this one. Anytime there's a metaphor, you have to take a drink. All right.
Of course, you had to go there, J-Mac.
Let us know how burst you get by the end of this one.
Absolutely. She is a very creative person, very, very artsy, and that's bloody brilliant because we need more of that in the world, and this world especially. But you know, to take your mind off of what's going on in life right now, here's something very positive, ladies and gentlemen. Judith A. Williams. So joining us on the Jibber Jabber podcast today to talk about her role as Claire in High Times is Judith Williams.
Hello.
Judith, how are you enjoying your time in lockdown, or are you enjoying your time?
Yeah, I guess like most folk, it's been wildly variable. Moments of like, oh, it's kind of amazing to have a pause and to slow down and to hang out with my daughter and to grow some seeds and hang out in the garden. And like, holy shit, what's happening to the world? But also part of me is like excited almost with the political movements, I guess, that are coming out of it. And I think people are a bit more engaged because we have more time and space to notice what's happening in the news and maybe reflect on it differently. So in a kind of like broad political sense, it's potentially exciting, if not definitely challenging. And of course, folk that are working at the coalface of the medical mishaps that the government have led us towards, tricky. But on a personal level, mostly having a nice time, which is a sort of strange thing to admit, but it's true.
How are you keeping yourself busy, other than seeding and
I've got a little girl, so she keeps me busy. She'll be four at the end of this month, at the end of July. So yeah, mostly I'm playing unicorns, reading a ton of stories, doing endless jigsaws, drawing a multitude of pictures, and helping her bounce on her trampoline.
It could be a lot worse, put it that way.
It could be a lot worse. I still do jazz singing, but I've also trained as a celebrant. So I was meant to be doing a ton of weddings this summer, which have all been cancelled. So a lot of the work that I would have been doing is now later in the year or next year. I've surrendered to reality and I'm hanging out with little Peggy.
I noticed as well on your social media that you regularly post poems and stuff like that and reviews of books and whatnot, and have you found that being useful for you to engage, you know, with your audience, to kind of do that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think I've been doing actually a message mastery course with an amazing lady called Susie Ashworth, and I'm kind of social media shy up to a point, but I see its purpose, especially in these times. Like, everybody's living their life through their computers and part of me rails against it, but there are meaningful connections to be found on all different platforms. So I'm like, all right, well, again, embrace what's real of this time and see if you can meet other people. And I think whenever I doubt that art is important, I'm like, well, music and poems have saved my life in some levels, or just like, you know, art that we relate to opens up spaces in us that we don't necessarily have the words for. it's like, oh, laughter. It's why I think High Times is a great show. It's like there's familiarity and laughter, and kind of being able to laugh at ourselves, I think, is one of the most crucial life skills.
Oh, like, absolutely. If you can't laugh at yourself, then
we're done for.
It's miserable.
Yeah. That's pretty much all this podcast is usually J-Mac and I laughing at ourselves, laughing at movies.
Life is absurd and ridiculous and beautiful and wonderful and all kinds of tragedy, but it is, I think, yeah, it's very crucial to stay soft, not to get brittle, is to be able to find comedy and things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found that even in this kind of darkness period that we're in, you always find light in the darkness of life. So I think, you know, and that's what we're doing right now. We're in lockdown, and most of our most positive stuff for our show, especially, we're spending more time with our family. We actually get to talk to nearly every cast member that's in High Times. I mean, that's something for us. Lockdown will be remembered as a really good positive time for us, you know, which is good. I mean, that's what you kind of want.
Yeah, and I think there are always jewels to be found, aren't there? I think there's so much about perspective. I was chatting to a friend before this, actually, and her latest nuance of awakening in the morning, but it's just a practice of gratitude. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I love the house that I'm in, or I love my skin, I love my legs that they can walk, I love that I can see, as opposed to like, oh, this is a nightmare, what is the world coming to, it's a disaster, whatever, climate change, and.
That's a really interesting kind of outlook. I might try that. Just wake up in the morning and go, this is all the good things I've got to fuck with the bad things. This is all the good stuff.
Genuinely, I do think that partly culturally, we're prone to sharing the wounds, aren't we? And just like, it's easier to say I had a hard day, I had a terrible day, I've been really busy, I'm tired, than it is to say, do you know what? I'm good. And I love my daughter and I love my life. And I'm really grateful that X, Y, and Z, that the sky is blue, that the flowers are growing. There's something, that we're not necessarily allowed to celebrate up to, where you're allowed to celebrate up to a certain point, and thereafter you're kind of like, oh, now. Yeah, you feed back into the reality of life.
Absolutely. So,
I was just going to say, sometimes you find that in different times in your life, you'll meet people and you just go, he's too fucking happy. I can't listen to him.
Yeah, my joy has been met with so much cynicism over the years. Genuinely, it's like, no, she's at it. I'm like, no, it's a work also to stay focused on the good stuff. I think it's not, most artists, I would say, do have like the cracks that like the light come in. It's Leonard Cohen lyric, I think, isn't it? And it's not necessarily the way I was brought up particularly, but it's like whatever helps you live your life fully and joyfully. It's like, for me, I'm like, brilliant, let's give it a bash.
Yeah,
you might have changed my whole attitude. I've got a gratitude attitude.
Gratitude attitude, there you go.
Gratitude.
There you go.
Gratitude. Brilliant. So one thing we have gratitude for is the amazing two series that you guys and John Rooney put together, which is obviously High Times. So how did you come across the High Times project? Were you approached, or did you kind of...
Beautiful segue, Kim. Yeah.
Thank you. I've been working on those over the years.
Crazy hippie back on track.
No.
Stephen and I were in Orphans together once upon a time. So yeah. I was in... I think it was my first piece of filming. I just seen with Doogie Henschel. So Stephen and I knew each other from Orphans. And then Paul and I were at Langside College together for a few months before, and then went off and did G-Force. Nice. I auditioned for the part of Claire, knowing that Stephen and Paul were on board. I was like, oh, come on, it would be great. But yeah, I auditioned for the part of Claire, and had also at the point committed to a theatre piece with one of my best friends, who I'm gladly still pals with. But I kind of had to make a choice between doing High Times and doing this piece with one of my dearest friends.
So I was
properly torn. But yeah, I loved John's writing and knew that I would be getting to work with Paul. I was like, I kind of have to, is what it felt like. So I did.
Yeah. So how did you kind of feel when, were you up against stiff competition for Claire, or did you kind of know when you were there?
You don't necessarily, there's at that time, there were a few actresses that I was kind of always in the room with, or you see folk outside, you're like, hi, hi, we're definitely here for the same part. But I think mostly in Scotland, there's a sense of like, well, whoever's going to get it's going to get it. And the more that I understand about the casting process, having been on both sides of it now, it's not whether or not you can act, it's actually just, do you fit with the atmosphere of the whole piece? So that has reduced my sense of like conflict or competition around like winning a part. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're mm-hmm. right, you're right. And if you're not, it's not because you're wrong. It's just because this isn't this time or this place or this piece. So I'm not sure who didn't get it, but I know that I did.
So when you got the part of Claire, did you find that upon reading the script that she was already, there was already elements of yourself in there, or did you kind of have to think outside the box to kind of get into the Claire headspace?
At the time I didn't have a daughter, so that was new. I was brought up in a flat in the west end of Glasgow, so the atmosphere of the high-rise flat was not necessarily familiar to me. Mm. I think what I understood is family, and I guess that's what cuts across class and religion and race and all that stuff. It's like, we know what interpersonal dynamics are. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, for me is like going from the inside out rather than the outside in. It's like, well, what does it mean to have to be living with your parents and bringing up a kid? Mm-hmm. That's kind of, for me, what the focus was. And I guess also like the love story essentially between Jimmy and Claire, it's like there was a real innocence and a flirtation that sat alongside being a young mother within this kind of strange setup. So yeah, I think that's what I felt like I got about Claire. And any character that you play, it's like not to sit in judgment of them, but just to love them and inhabit them and embody them.
Yeah. And did you knew that Paul was on board at that point? Did you know that he was Jimmy?
Or did I actually read with Andy Clark, and I went in because they started pairing people up at a certain point to see. And Paul and I had chatted on the phone, I think, and he's like, "That I will be." Actually, I don't know if I can say this. I'm going to say it. I'll be pissed off if I don't get the part, because he'd played the part of Jimmy, hadn't he, in the short film version of it.
Yeah. Paul did, yeah.
And then when it came to doing the TV series, other folk were up for the part of Jimmy, so I think he was like, ooh. And so knowing him, I was like, oh, I hope that we get to go in together. So maybe whoever it was he first read with was actually up for it, and then when Andy and I went in, I don't know, I swung it. Who knows?
Absolutely. Did you know initially because I asked John Rooney this, and he kind of gave us a different answer. Did you know that Rab Campbell was going to end up being Chloe's dad initially in the early stages?
I don't know if I did. I think because there's a scene between Stephen and I in the lift when I think there's like some joke about getting into my pants now, there's already one arsehole in there.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
And I can't remember when we played that scene if I knew at that point that Claire was being defensive because she was kind of being protective of the reality. I honestly, it was 15 years ago. What was John's answer?
He said that it was to be played with, because that Davey Mackay had come up with that and said, look, here's the idea, but we're not going to focus on it. We're just going to kind of let it play out and see where it goes, kind of thing. I almost felt like he was trying to shy away for whether it was an actual plan. But the reason I ask that is because in episode one, the very first episode, when Claire and Rab are in the elevator together, and then you kind of get out the elevator and you kind of, it's almost like a flirtation. She's like, bye. And your mother comes walking over, Alice, and she goes, and the door shuts, and she goes back to Eddie, and she's like, what color's his eyes? Rab Campbell. And he's like, oh, he doesn't look at you long enough. And I thought, there was the seed. There was the seed.
It's interesting because I think, I'm not sure when the first series was written, if the second series had written, because the identity of the father was revealed in the second series, wasn't it?
That's right,
So I think what Davey and John were saying, it's like it was a possibility, but they weren't going to confirm anything because I guess it wasn't the focus of the storylines at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't actually. I remember actually watching it going, I wonder if...
Claire must have known who it was.
Oh, she, yeah, which again, so if you go back to the first season, when you know, because I've binged the series, like both series about six times now, right? And I'm watching, and Claire, like from when she knows that everybody knows, when it's outed, the way she interacts with Rab's far different to what it was in the very first season. You just wouldn't have known, eh? And she, kudos to Claire for like going along with that. It must have been a lot of weight to hold, right?
Well, I guess it is that thing. You don't, she obviously didn't want everyone to know that he was the father because she was ashamed or embarrassed or didn't. Yeah, it's like, however she wanted to play it out, that he wasn't involved.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I guess there are a lot of kids and you don't, I mean, I had always assumed it was clear that she, my hunch with her is that she didn't sleep with a ton of people. So she probably had a good idea that it was him. Yeah. I can't remember if it was written into the script or not, in terms of the character briefing.
Yeah.
But the fact that we had moments together felt like, well, it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I guess, what kudos to Claire to be so pally with him, or kudos to Claire to keep it stoom?
All. I mean, for what she was carrying then on her back,
yeah,
and to still see him every day and be so friendly and kind of not let it get in the way of her normal everyday life whilst, you know, crossing paths. Because if you look back to the first season, there's points where you like, Rab, I keep saying you, like you and Stephen, your characters, you know, there's that part where you actually turn to Rab and you say, I'm struggling to get a man to look at me, but she goes through guys like her dad goes through Jaffa Cakes. And you're talking about Tracy. And together you're kind of just pallying about. You know what I mean? So for to have that, and Claire knew that Rab didn't know because he was shit-faced. And then she's raising this child alone. She knows it's Rab. She's got no support from Rab. And I just felt like it's a lot to weight to carry and to still not treat him any different, you know, to kind of keep
I guess,
that.
Like, as a on the side of the fathers, wouldn't you want to know? Because I guess like Stephen and I chatted about it when we played the scene where he found out and he was properly like, the weight of it. Because I do wonder if it's fair to not tell a father that they are the father. Because it was a weight for Claire, but it also it's like, well, was it her choice to refuse him the joy and the struggle and the challenge of being a parent?
Yeah.
I don't know, it's like, I don't know. There are men out there that have found out after the fact and down the line and might have wanted to know sooner.
Yeah. It's
probably a much more familiar situation for so many couples, not couples, so many people out there that are in that situation.
Uh-huh.
Like, what do I do? This guy is a total waster. It goes the other way as well. Like the guy has made the mistake and she's an absolute nutter. And you don't know, nobody knows how to handle the situation.
Yeah.
And,
it's,
I think Claire's approach seemed to be a really sensible approach to make sure that Chloe had the best chance.
Until, I mean, I think everybody's in agreements until that scene with Rab and Chloe in season two. That's when you're like, well, did Claire make the right decision? Because look, how good was that scene though, right?
Yeah, I remember Stephen and I sitting on that bed and he'll tell you himself, but he was listening to Hallelujah, Jeff Buckley's song, because that's what brought it on for him, that sense of vulnerability. And he was like, do you want to listen to it too? And I was like, I don't think that's Claire's story.
Yeah.
Because at that point, Claire and Jimmy were leaving Glasgow and going to Manchester.
Yeah.
So in a way, I think that it was kind of clear to reveal it at that point, but also with him knowing that he'd likely never see Chloe again, or if it was because it was in passing and maybe when we were back visiting Chloe's, you know, granny and granddad, that then he would see her.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of, yes, this child is yours and we're leaving tomorrow.
Yeah.
I want to cry.
I think that's the only time you kind of be like, it's the only time in both series where you're like, come on, Claire. You know what I mean? Come on. There's a sense of that.
And it was kind of hard to play because we were sat side by side. And obviously at some point, you know, we had an intimate moment. Rab and I. And so it's like, and sitting there sharing the vision of a daughter with someone that you know is their kind of genetic other half.
Yeah.
And it's, you see, you also in that moment really see a softer side to Rab, because at that point, I don't know, he's not the clown, he's not the buffoon, he's not the whatever else he was, like
stoner. Well, he's still a stoner. He was still a stoner.
In a different way, I think.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's the mistake people, when folk are like, oh, she's too like joyous, laughter, silly, stupid. Like, we assume that folk are one note and nobody is one colour.
Yeah, I mean, if Rab had known from the beginning when you were when Claire was pregnant, it's so hard to make that break. God, when Claire was pregnant, it could have been the making of him as well. That's scary. If you remember when Eddie calls him a waster, it really takes it to heart. Even tries to get a job completely unsuccessfully. it could have been the making of him. But again, it's one of these things that you can look at it in so many different ways and just go, you know what happened. So, but that's just the way it goes. We can't change it. It's already been on.
And I think also it's like we all make the best decisions we can at the time with the information that we've got, like on and off the screen. If you know what I mean, it's just like this is the story that we're telling. A multitude of other things could have happened, but this is the way that it's going. Yeah. So yeah, it's a bit of a moral dilemma, isn't it? It's like, do you deny a father access rights to his child because he's a bit of a plonker?
I mean, it's these life's decisions. There's one little change in your past could mean you're in a completely different place than where you would have been.
Life mirroring, I am a single mother. So there we go. I know more about Claire now than I did then.
His name's no Rab, right?
Oh.
Oh, I mean, so.
And your daughter's four.
She'll be four at the end of July. And she's with her dad tonight. This is why I've got coffee, amaretto, and water just off camera.
Oh, nice. Nice.
That's an interesting combination.
I can't keep
when you were actually making the show, when you were a part of it, did you know when you were shooting it that it was going to be as good as it turned out to be?
It felt special is what I can say. It's like it was one of the jobs that I'm proudest of, and I think all of our hearts were in it. There's some jobs that you do for the money, and the money was not good.
We've heard that.
I mean, it really wasn't. When you always a pot, anyway. You know, Caroline absolutely believed in it. John absolutely believed in it. Davey believed in it. That we were all utterly on board.
Yeah.
And cared about all of the characters and cared about the heart of the piece, I think. And I do remember sitting with, you know, my mum and dad, Alison and John, but just sitting having really beautiful chats because we really got to spend time together. Like, it did feel like it was an ensemble piece. Mm-hmm. Quite often, like, bit parts that I've done in whatever, you know, River City and Taggart and the book group, you rock up and you do your day and you're off again. The book group, not so much because we did have rehearsals. But what was lovely for me about High Times, and I think a general sense on the set, was like there was time taken to rehearse scenes. Mm-hmm. And David particularly is also an actor, so he kind of understands why that matters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's sometimes when these things are rushed, there were no rehearsals, stuff like that, it really does, it shows later on. Especially, I'd imagine, especially as if you're part of it, like you must sometimes actors must watch scenes and go, oh, Jesus, we totally rushed that.
Yeah, it's also, I think sometimes, you know, in the edit, they were like, oh, there's a booming shot. So actually, another take emotionally would have been better, but technically, they kind of need to use the one that doesn't look like something went woefully wrong.
Yeah.
So, like, there's so much, you've got to trust the editor so much. And that's the strange thing, I guess, working in TV or film, is that you hand it over to the editing process. Well, yeah. I mean, like this podcast, you could make me sound like an absolute fool, whereas I've been incredibly...
Impossible.
But there is something about trusting the process and trusting each other. And it's like, do you know what? I know if we spend another 5 minutes, we're going to get a greater depth of layer to this scene. So let's just do it again. Mm-hmm. But I guess... the director is in a very particular position in relation to the producer, in relation to the assistant director, and the time, and because often what takes the longest is setting up the shot and getting the lighting right and making sure there are no shadows. And sometimes within the technicality of it all, the heart of the piece can, that scene or that moment can sort of evaporate.
Yeah.
There was a lot of care from the crew as well. Like, they were super tender. Like, yeah, they got it. So it felt like whatever happened, we'd be proud of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
With regards to working a lot, like most of your scenes are with Jimmy Paul McCall. When we spoke to him, he said that he felt obviously a real privilege to be there among all you actors and stuff, and that he was really nervous. And did you get that from him, or what was it like to work with Paul McCall?
There was something about his energy that really suited Jimmy.
Yeah.
Especially in the first series, the kind of just a wee bit shy and a wee bit back foot and a wee bit kind of, and in some ways it let Claire step, like move towards him in a different way, because it's like, oh, you're like, she saw the loveliness in him, even if he couldn't see it himself. And so in that way, like, Paul and I have known each other for a few years, I guess, like at distance in a way. So I quite enjoyed the push and pull between us, the kind of will they, won't they, and the dance of that dynamic. I get, I mean, everybody gets nervous on set because you're like, I don't want to be the person that wrecks the schedule by not getting this done on time, or like, so there is a very particular nervous pressure that you're like, well, actually that's not the energy I should necessarily be carrying in that scene.
Yeah.
But my lasting impression of Paul is definitely not like, oh, he was so edgy. He was beautiful to work with, and I've got all the time in the world for him.
Yeah. He said the same pretty much about you, about the beautiful and all the time in the world.
But it's so, tomorrow,
you know, that's one thing that we've kind of picked up upon when we're speaking to each of you individually, is every time we bring up a name, you all go, oh, do you know, I needed to see, you know, it's, it really is like reuniting a band that have toured together, you know. Jimmy, obviously, his voice is pretty much the voice of that show. It pretty much closes every episode. And you yourself are a really, really good jazz singer. Did John Rooney know that you were able to sing? In fact, did you know you were able to sing?
Well, yes, because because I had just auditioned for the Royal Academy of Music in London before just after we recorded the first series, I went to study in London for a year, and I did a postgraduate in musical theatre. I have a distinction in tap dancing.
Oh, wow.
And so yeah, they knew that I sang, but it didn't feel, I think by then it was written, and it would have probably been a bit of a elbowed segue to for me suddenly to be singing beautiful harmonies with Jimmy's song and us becoming, I don't know, Cher and Sonny of High Times. A third series, who knows?
Well, you know, that could have been the start of something there. Jimmy humming away in an elevator, and then you get in, Claire gets in, and together they make sweet music, right?
Yep, all the metaphors.
He's really good at that. You'll notice he's probably done about 15 since we started. We'll just keep on going.
God. So did you, obviously you're working a lot with Paul McCall, but I imagine you would have been able to see a lot of other scenes getting filmed and spent a lot of time with the cast and crew. Is there any like really funny stories or insane stories that you can kind of remember off the top of your head?
I remember Paul gave me a note one day and it was totally valid. He's like, you wouldn't hold your own kid like that. Because Chloe that was in, like I was holding, because she's someone else's baby. I'm like, I don't want to hurt her. I don't want to drop her. But Paul had kids by that point. So he was just like that, just hoist her, like take it under your arm. So I was like trying to sort of like woman handle this baby, but not really knowing. Now that I've got Peggy, I'm like, all right, yeah, you just do whatever you need to do to make it happen. So I think that for me is a kind of moment of reflection. I'm like, all right, that was helpful, Paul. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a strange setup in that the flat that we were filming, or the flat next door to where we were filming, had a really brutal story behind it. Like, as I understand it, a mother had thrown her child from the balcony. And so this is not a funny story. This is a pretty gruesome story, but like maybe facts check it. But that's one of my lasting memories of the atmosphere of the, not the flats that we were filming in, but like the opposite side of that landing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the flats were being emptied out at the time. So it was a kind of, it was quite a strange moment to be going there and feeling almost like a bit of a tourist in that part of town. But it's fine because, I mean, Tony and I ended up doing Sunshine and Leith together. Cora and I like bump into each other more than most. Mm-hmm. Steph I haven't seen for years, but the kind of John Comerford I still go and get my hair cut with.
Yeah, we just found out that he's actually a hairdresser, right? Yeah,
no idea.
Be appalled by my lockdown kitchen system effort.
That's the least it can do for sniffing your drawers, though, right?
In the show, in the show. This is libel. And I'm assuming they were prop pants, so there's no issue.
They were prop pants, and they. Because I think during that scene, I do remember a bit of like costume comedy. I was like, I'm not. We had to get a long t-shirt. I was like, look, I really don't want my arse hanging out, thanks. Well, please, can you get like a long t-shirt? But they were like, yeah, but it needs to look like it would fit Jimmy. I was like, yeah, but it needs to cover my arse. I want to say, please.
You wore it very well.
I think I actually remember as you got up off the couch, you still gave it a hook down just to make sure the camera didn't catch it.
I had like fluorescent bikini shorts underneath that t-shirt because I was like, that they're not getting away with any flash anything. So I wore like deliberately not very subtle pants.
That's a great idea.
Well,
I need to remember that one for all my pant shots.
Yes, dude. The DOP probably would have preferred a flesh-coloured brief that would have been a more subtle. I was like, no, no, my modesty will come first.
And then you walk through the room and you see Tex. And modesty's just gone.
John actually does still cut your hair?
He does still cut my hair. And he has actually introduced me a few times, like in Jess Fubu, he's like, oh yeah, this is Jude. I've sniffed her knickers. You're like, he's not actually sniffed my pants. We were in a shirt together.
That you know of anyway.
Yeah. Oh Jesus. We're going to have to speak to him at some point. He'll probably listen to this.
No, in fact, do you know what? Seeing his episode, that is getting brought up. Like I'm asking him, like, what did prop pants smell like? Because the way you described it. God damn. That took a turn.
Oh, wow. But, yeah. See, this is welcome to the Jibber Jabber podcast.
Now everybody's thinking about my pants.
Prop pants.
Oh, man.
Shall we talk about jazz again?
So it would have been quite cool to have seen, you know, you guys. And I like to think that nothing's really over. So I've told myself in my mind that a season 3 could definitely be possible. Even so, you could use that distance between the second series to a third series as, you know, storytelling. And I'd like to think that Jimmy and Claire are still together. And maybe we would see a bit of a duet.
Maybe we have made an album. Maybe
right? Maybe not an album, but...
Why not an album? An EP?
Well, I don't know. I reckon Jimmy...
online release?
Well, that could work. For me, I pictured it like you're washing the dishes singing and he's singing with you, drying them, and then you've got Chloe putting them away.
A 16-year-old putting dishes away? No, that's not happening.
Do you know Robin, who was our daughter in it, is a singer now.
Wow, is she?
Yeah, you should get her on. Robin Ashford, I'm going to get it wrong, but she's on Facebook, right. And she confronted me recently, and she's like, oh, I think we worked together once upon a time. I was like, did we? Oh, you're a grown-up. Okay.
I can't imagine sitting around going, so how was it to work on High Times?
Yeah. Well, true, you might not be able to reflect.
Like, I was staring at a lot of ceilings.
What it would like to be held at my bosom.
At one point, this hairdresser was blowing smoke in my face. text.
Aye, that's right. John was sitting there with a fag. I bet she wasn't there for that. That's the magic
she
of
what, she wouldn't have been. I mean,
yeah, she wouldn't have been there for that. Even back in 2004, there was rules.
That was not cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned about the atmosphere in the flat on the other side of the flats. Did you actually feel like there was a kind of a tension in the air or some kind of just sad feeling kicking about?
Yeah, I think it just felt really, I mean, yeah, it was, there was no one living there and the flats were being emptied at the time and they were about to be knocked down. So there was a kind of a weird atmosphere anyway. And like, I'm not particularly, I'd say spiritual, but not religious, but there's a sense that places do hold atmosphere and it did feel to me, it's just like, oh, this odd. And mm-hmm. I asked about it one day and that was the story that was revealed.
Right.
So yeah, it did feel strange. I mean, the rooms that we filmed in, that was one of the joys, I think, was that the art department could really like go to town on the details of it. Yeah. And it did feel like, you know, you were sitting in your family's couch after a while, because you know, we spent quite a lot of time in the sitting room, we're then in Jimmy's flat. And but yeah, the atmosphere of the flat next door did feel odd to me. And I think it's quite a difficult area. And there was like security men all the time, because there's quite a lot of expensive gear that was there. So there were a few incidents with the security at certain points along the way. But by and large, folk have, like, were massively supportive and excited. And,
yeah. Right. John had actually told us that he had to get security in because gangsters were trying to like make them pay to use the flats.
Right, okay. We were not told the degree to which stuff was going on, but we just got...
Right.
Yeah, we're just having to be a bit careful. I'm like, all right, okay.
Ironically, who do you think runs the security firms? most of the time, it's gangsters. I'll tell you that.
Oh, well, then.
And I do remember, like, I'm born and bred in the west end of Glasgow and walking back up, like, the Leaf. One day that had been a particularly hard day of filming, I can't remember what the story was. I was like, man, I was tired, and got back. I was like, can you just drop me at the end of the street? And walking by the botanics, like under the leafy green, and it was summertime, and just how, yeah, grateful I felt in a way to know, like, Glasgow's multicoloured and multicultural and multi-layered, and I love it. And just feeling in that moment what an atmosphere of a place does to us in terms of, like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, yeah, the atmospheres that we live within are bound to impact on us. So was really acutely aware, I guess, of how lucky I was and how fortunate I was, and also kind of duty and honour and responsibility to feel a bit like, it's like, I don't want to be parachuting into someone else's life, like needing and wanting for it to feel genuinely authentic and loving and kind and full of humour, which it absolutely was. And I think that's the beauty of John's writing. There was no sense of it being, I don't know, poverty porn or any of that stuff. It was like the beauty of these families and these humans was their genuine struggle to make life rich.
It's a show that, there's genuinely no bad people in the show. There's just people with issues.
They
really do. I mean, the first time, it's like the first time you watch it, you're like, Alison, she's a bitch. And then you watch it again, and you're like, no, she's not. She's struggling with something. And then even Rab, he makes an effort at one point. You're like, he's a good boy. And then when he goes to find Eddie's dad, he finds Eddie's dad and takes him up to his flat to look after him until Eddie gets home and stuff like that. And it's like, he's flawed, but he's a good guy at heart, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in most of the characters. You're the only character that's kind of genuinely good all the time. you're the good girl in the show.
Yes, but I would argue the fact now, it's like, was it good not to tell Rab? It's like, but it was a bit of a moral dilemma, really.
Yeah, there is that.
But at the end of the day, she was young and naive, so everyone's allowed their flaws, and I think maybe that she's human, right? At the end of the day, she done like what you said, with information and her own experience, that was the right, that felt right to her at that point. You know, and I think even it's confirmed when Rab even says himself, you know, you'll do better with Jimmy and Claire.
He
relinquishes that, doing the most selfless thing.
He's generous in that moment, definitely. I think if we were to revisit, if there was another another series. Mm-hmm. John, I'll give him a phone too. This but it would be interesting, like, for me, in terms of race politics, because a lot of the issues, I think, in terms of immigration and refugees coming to Glasgow and refugees, particularly in light of the recent stabbings in town, it's like there's part of me, it's like that when folk that are struggling are put side by side so blatantly and so obviously and so condensedly, like, for me, it would be a moment to explore how that could play out differently in our world. Mm-hmm. If, particularly in terms of, like, the Black Lives Matter movement, I'm, you know, conscious even more than I would have been then. It's like, you know, there wasn't a gay character, there wasn't a trans anybody, there wasn't anyone of colour, there wasn't anyone in a wheelchair. It's like, there's, in terms of the demographic, it could, if we were to revisit it, I would hope in a way that it would be broader in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think one of the charms of the show is the fact that it is quite compact and you really do get to know a few characters. I mean, there's only how many main characters are there?
I think there were four households.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a
Rab
lot.
Rab and Jake, Jimmy and his uncle.
Not a lot of people. But I mean, I think with more of a budget, that very well could have happened at the time. When you could have ventured away from the block of flats, because you're pretty much there for the whole time. Any exterior shots were next to the flats and stuff.
Limited. So. But I think you're right in terms of it feeling condensed. Like, that's one of its beauties. It's like, it's the same setup, but a different story. Yeah. And that is part of the cleverness of it, I think, is the condensedness that all of these lives happen in this kind of sandwich with each other.
Yeah. You think the fact that the flats were getting, obviously the plan was to get them knocked down, eventually obviously they were knocked down. Do you think that put a kind of time limit on how long the show would run?
I think what happened was that Cracked had also been filmed around the same time. Mm. And so they released High Times over 2 years, I think, and then Cracked was released. I think if STV hadn't had another drama in the pipeline, they might have then invested in another series 3 and 4.
Right.
So it was partly, as I understand it was partly a programming thing. It's like, well, we've got something else that's going to fill that gap, so we don't actually need to make anything else. Because money is always an issue, like, when it comes to arts and investment, which is a tragedy, I think, because I think for, you know, the emotional and mental well-being of society, it's really crucial. Like I said, music and poetry and art of all kinds have saved people's lives and kind of shed light in ways that you need it. And for me, music's been a lifeline in lockdown.
Yeah,
it's like you change your soundtrack and you change your day.
So
anyone that argues that arts is kind of superfluous or like that's a ridiculous thing to fund, it's like, no, it's the first thing that we should fund. It's part of our healthcare system, I would argue.
That's a really,
it is, because
that's a really good point.
Health doesn't just necessarily mean it's something physical. Your mental health is just as important as your physical health. And I think for me, I've been playing music for about 15 years. And that was one thing that when I was growing up, a lot of my friends were trying weed, getting high, taking drugs, doing whatever, just whatever normal teenagers do. I was stuck in the music room learning to teach myself how to play different instruments because music for me was just a new universe, almost opened you up. And you know what, as well, the people that create the music, they give you their story and you turn that story into your own, you know? And that's why when I listen to a song now that I heard 13 years ago, it takes me back to that place. And it's almost like a maze and you kind of navigate your way through it, but it's a maze that's made up of you. And that's the way I look at music.
Mm. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to, just the other day, I had a notion to listen to Yellow by Coldplay. I don't know where it came from. I was like, I've not heard that song since it was out, basically. And I was like, I used to quite enjoy that. I put it on. It took me back to being 15, I'm sure it was, when that came out.
Yeah, it's fun. But it opens up a different filing cabinet in your memory or something. It's like, oh, it's somewhere in our psyches and our systems.
Yeah, it's just a big library. So the show won. It won a BAFTA. And
a SCAFTA, I like to think of it as
a SCAFTA. So I mean, that sounds like some kind of kebab, doesn't it?
a SCAFTA
with extra hummus, thanks.
So, were you there that night for the BAFTA win?
I was. I was studying in London at the time, and I was like, I've got to go. Like, partly because I wanted to see everybody again. Mm-hmm. And it's, I had been in London for, I don't know, 8 months or something. I was like, oh, I'm going to go to see everyone. And because it's a moment, and as an actor, you spend many moments when you're not doing glitzy things, and many moments you're like, I'm in the dole queue, or here I am waitressing, or here I am cleaning up ashtrays in a pub, here I am doing absolutely not the thing I said I wanted to do. So when those moments come along to celebrate, it's like, yep, whatever happens, mm-hmm. I'm going to be there. So I kind of revisited a dress that I'd worn to my brother's wedding. Got myself a sleeper train up from London, because I think we were coming to a moment in the course where I had to, I don't know, we had like a big performance on at the weekend or something like that. So I could only do it for like a 24-hour stint. So I got like the sleeper up, spent the day in Glasgow, and then got the sleeper back down, which was a bit of a travesty because I was like, oh, but the party.
Did you miss the party? Did you miss the party?
I was at the event. I was at the kind of hotel, but I couldn't go to the aftermath. Oh. I was like, not anymore.
Last time Claire went to a party, she ended up with a child. Right? That one.
I mean, that must have been really nice to get that recognition.
Yeah. I can't imagine. Funny, my lockdown clear out, actually, but we've got a bangle, I think they get, which with a silver bangle that has BAFTA on it. I found it the other day in my lockdown clear out. So wow. It's become part of Peggy's dress-up drawing.
Oh, nice. I was about to say there, do you keep that as some kind of, you know, a shrine to some of your achievements?
No. So,
nope.
Not so much. Not much. But partly, actually, this that's uh-huh. behind me that you won't see on the podcast, in Tapestry, this I bought when I was doing a show in Mexico, a theatre piece a few years ago, and it was in a box for a while. And then a friend of mine committed suicide. And I was like, why do we keep things in boxes? We're here now and we need to celebrate life. So I've since hung it up in my kitchen. But I think there is something in celebrating what it is that we are and where mm-hmm. we are, and not kind of waiting until whatever special day it might be that I bring that bracelet out again. Like, I haven't worn it for 10 years. So mm-hmm. it's like, Peggy's going to get joy playing with it now. Let her have that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That's why you can see from around us all our cool stuff. I mean, where we are right now is where this is our wee hub space that our wives are like, you have this, keep all your stuff in there so that it's not in the house because we're not teenagers.
It's your shed, essentially. Right.
It's essentially that, absolutely.
I'm just getting the drawings done to get this garage converted properly. I can't wait.
Oh, nice. Are you in a garage?
Yeah, I'm in the garage, yeah.
Doesn't look like a garage, yeah.
Doesn't look like a garage.
if I turn it that way, you see the big brick wall, and that's where the garage door is. There's a curtain there.
So nice.
It's definitely still a garage, but it's in the works. I cannot wait. I'm gonna get. I haven't told her yet, but I'm getting a home cinema system.
which means he's not getting a home cinema system.
That means I'm getting a 17-inch telly and a packet of popcorn.
It's so true. So looking back on High Times, I mean, everybody we spoke to has totally been, we spoke to Cora first, then we talked to John, spoke to Paul, Stephen, we've spoke to him about it previously a few times, but he's also going to be doing it next.
Steve.
And everybody that's talked about it is all, they just bring so much love to the conversation when they're talking about High Times. I mean, one thing we've not asked is, you know, what was it like working with Alison and John as your parents?
We kind of knew each other from theatre world, I think. Mm-hmm. We actually ended up working together again on Playhouse Creatures up at Dundee Rep.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we had a really lovely relationship. John, I remember him sitting down one day on the couch beside him, and we had a really nice father-daughter relationship. Mm-hmm. Because I think, like you said, Alison in the show, my mum in the show, was a bit of a like spiky, angsty mother-daughter spikes thing happening. So, and that wasn't our off-screen relationship at mm-hmm. all. But there is something when you're like waiting for the shot to be set up that you kind of want to hold the atmosphere of whatever the scene is that you're about to go into. Mm-hmm. So John and I particularly sat and had like beautiful heart-to-hearts, and it was lovely also because he'd been in the business for far longer than I had, like just kind little asides and chatting about camera angles. And yeah, there was a real respect and love between us, I think. Like, we all wanted the best for the show and each other.
Yeah.
And Alison at the time, have you spoken to Alison? No,
not yet. She's coming up though.
Ah, cool. There was one scene where she had to wear, she came in and wearing my dress, I think.
That's right. Oh, look, Granny's wearing Mummy's dress. Yeah. Yeah. Don't call me that.
We know this show quite well now.
I should probably watch an episode just to remind myself. I'll maybe go ahead and watch it now as part of my lockdown.
Oh, your STV player. STV player. Yeah.
Don't watch it on YouTube, but you can definitely find it on STV player. You can find it either or, but you'll watch one episode.
DVD.
Oh, wow. Is this before it cost £80 on Amazon?
True.
No.
£80 on Amazon. I mean, it's a good show, but God. £80.
If I signed it, I could have even more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you're going to check out the full... You'll find yourself watching episode one and then it'll roll on to episode two. And before you know it, you'll be phoning John going, when are we doing a season three? I mean, that's pretty much what we've done.
What you're hoping is going to be the outcome of this series?
This is absolutely, I mean, we're not even lying.
It's a secret.
What else have you imagined for the characters, for their future? So,
I had actually spoken to quite a few of the, like Cora as well. You know how Frank had split up with his missus? Those two, because I hear that that Frank in real life has actually lost a lot of weight, right, Tony? So I thought to myself, right, they split up and we never got to see those two guys get back together. And even though we did want it, I mean, we always kind of felt it was going to happen anyway, but they kind of had to get some stuff out of their system. He was obviously holding her back. She wanted the life, and he just completely was too lazy to give a shit. But now all this time has passed, I imagined that for whatever reason, maybe Tracy gets engaged and they've got to get together at a party. For the first time, they come together in, say, 15 years, and they arrange to be civil. She's, like, taken back, like, wow, look how good you look after all these years, right? And she starts to see that he's become the man that she wanted, say, 15 years ago. And together they kind of rekindle, like, gradually through a friendship, and it just kind of comes full circle that way. I think that would be amazing.
Oh, romantic, Kev. It's very sweet.
Oh, that's beautiful, Kev.
That's just what I imagined. If there never is a season three, that's how it plays out in my head. You know,
I like to think. Well, I don't like to think. I think Rab and Jake have fallen out. They've had a big fallout, and Jake has actually made something of himself.
Because he always would have if he never knew Rab, right? Yeah. You could just tell he would have been better in society.
He is thick, though. He's thick as mince, but he's probably really creative.
Yeah.
More creative than, I don't know, like a foil thing.
He definitely had good parents that told him to stay away from Rab, and he didn't listen.
I think Rab's still Rab. Mm-hmm. There could be something with Chloe trying to make contact with him and him being reluctant, maybe kind of warming up to the idea, stuff like that. It's all these wee nuances that I'm sure John can work out, so get on it.
Right, John. Yeah, and that kind of brings Jimmy and Claire back to the series as well, you know? Because I imagine at this point, everybody's away, but the rekindling between Rab and Chloe would be the reason for Jimmy and Claire to kind of get involved again.
Yeah, I guess also because Chloe would come up to visit. Presumably they would be coming up to visit their grandparents. Mm-hmm. So there could be some of that going on.
Yeah, so I'm just picturing the way they look now, because obviously we've seen Paul yesterday, we've seen Stephen a couple of times, and I can just imagine like the knock at the door and Jimmy opening it, and there's Rab.
Oh man, the feels. That would be amazing, right?
You know, there's Rab with he's still got quite long hair. But he has to wear glasses now because he smoked too much fucking weed. And he's got his wee beard, and I can picture it all, and it's a nice picture.
Nice. Claire and Jimmy might have had other kids of their own.
Yeah. Aye, and Tex has been married another twice.
Tex is married to a really young. Like, he's married to like a 25-year-old gold digger, and she doesn't know he's not got any money.
And Rab gets her pregnant after a party and forgets all about it.
We're writing it now, John. We need the rights, mate.
No.
Copyright this.
There's issues there. There's issues to be worked out.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll get the lawyers on it.
After lockdown, there is a plan. I've kind of already spoken to a venue. J-Mac and myself, he calls himself J-Mac for some reason. But we as a podcast have tried to do as much in our community as possible. So what we've done is we went to a local cinema that's not owned by any big companies, just run by a man that owns it. And we said to them, like, how would you feel about us kind of merging with you? And what will happen is we will put on movies from the past that we couldn't see in the cinema because we weren't alive, and mm-hmm. classic movies such as The Goonies, Neverending Story and stuff. And what we'll do is bring our podcast audience to the cinema, which will generate sales. We don't want paid anything for it. All we'd like is the time to interact with our audience and to promote it. We'll put all the promotion behind it, and we've done it 5 times now, and it's been successful. It made them a lot of money, and so we're now in good relationship with them. So the next plan, which I got a verbal yes, absolute yes to, was how would you feel if we took over the cinema and reunited the cast of High Times, and we play maybe an episode or two on the 4K screen. We get the script that John wrote that never became an episode, and we have the guys read it. We do a Q&A, just a proper fan fest that reunites everybody, and we get to see it, right?
And then we all get pished.
Okay.
You know?
I would take a commission, though. Speak to them about a 10% if they're selling out the cinema. But anyway,
but it'll be good. That's the plan, and I think it's literally just down to all you guys agreeing to do it and making that work.
Yeah, like you say, that there is a big fondness between everyone. So I think if everyone's available, I'm sure we'd all sign up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
where is the cinema?
It's in a place called Bathgate. I mean, do you know where that is? Right. So I mean, it's central to Bathgate. Subo might even show up. She lives like a stone throw away. But I mean, we've built a really good relationship with them, and we believe in this reunion, and we believe that if we put enough steam into this, maybe there'll be, the stars will align and everything comes together at the right place, and we could maybe see a season 3. And you know, no one says that it wouldn't work because, you know, everybody's moved on. It could absolutely work because that time gives us more to work with, right?
Uh-huh. You've had John on already, have you?
Yeah.
What was Caroline saying to the producer? I guess we need
so we've not had her on yet. John absolutely was like, there's more in me, let's speak after lockdown. So Stephen, everybody that we've spoken to all have the exact same feeling towards it as we do. And
yeah,
you know,
it is funny because there was definitely a momentum with it, and it's like surely, and time went on, you're like, oh, I don't think it is gonna happen.
Yeah,
we've heard a few kind of different, like, obviously you've given reasons for why. Reasons. Yeah. I think there's probably a multitude of reasons, and everybody will know different reasons, and that's it's one of the things that we want to get to the bottom of, because we deserve more.
I just think
I'm sure we'll all have like 5% of the picture, and somewhere in the middle is the actual truth. I don't know. Yeah.
I just need to find the person that owns the crystal ball, and I'm just going to go, can I have that, please? I mean, you're not using it. So at least, I mean, I'll not make anything from it. Just let me release it into the ether, man. Give it back to those.
Here's another metaphor. Another one.
Give it back. Yeah, man. So, you know, that literally, I mean, when we first spoke to Stephen about his career and stuff, we actually met before lockdown, so we actually got to do it in person, and we had a great time, and he talked about High Times and we revisited it, and it just kind of lit a fire because of how good the show was. And it's like, you know, if your favorite band broke up in the 80s and you've listened to the greatest hits, and then you know they're going to reform, man. That's the feeling that we get with this, because it's just, there's so much more, and I just think we could really explore that. You know?
You're ready for another album.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Oh, you're good at the metaphors. I'm just going to turn my mic off.
So looking back on the show, I mean, I imagine if you got a call from John tomorrow, you would totally be up for.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And there is something, like, the only other thing I could, like, Orlando that I went to Mexico with was a show that I revisited. So I did it and then 2 years later came back to the script. So there is something really beautiful about repetition, and I think, like you say, 10 years in their lives, like all manner of things could have happened. So there's, yeah, there's mileage in it.
Yeah. I mean, think about
a fondly remembered show, like certainly from my perspective.
Yes. From everyone's. Yeah. I mean, it's not, if you think about the law of attraction, is it by accident that you come on this Zoom call with the same haircut as you did in season two where it finished?
And I am a single mother. Basically, I've just lived my life trying to be Claire.
Right. You're ready to take Claire to the next step, right?
I mean, I haven't changed a bit. Who would have thought?
No, do you know, the only one thing I would say that's different between you and Claire is your voice.
Yeah, I'm posher than Claire.
Right. Do you remember how to do Claire? Could you even give us a line from Claire?
Because I remember Davey saying to me, when I came back to the second series, he was like, "Now, Jude, you've been to London studying musical theatre, but she hasn't, so..."
She hasn't. <there. laughs> Aye, for sure. Yeah, that's
because my dad's a Welshman and my mum has roots in Tarbertlough Fine, so I've got a very like West Coast Celtic hybrid accent.
Yeah.
Sure. See, I find it hard to... I speak relatively well, I like to think, right? But I find it hard to kind of bring it down to that kind of... like. I just go full med if I try and do that kind of voice. And that's, I find it hard to get the balance of just going to a kind of real Glaswegian accent. I'll just go straight for that, you know what I mean?
I have to thank Paul for my performance in High Times. He also said to me, he's like, "Now, dude, you live here, but that doesn't mean that you're a junkie, or it doesn't mean that you just..." Yeah. Like you say, it's like not overdoing anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my wife was brought up in Bishop Briggs, so she's definitely sounds Glaswegian, but she's not like that. And but I can't even do her accent. Whenever I try and do an impression of her to wind her up, I just go right. And it's really hard to do. So I commend you for that. It's not easy.
I think that is one of the, like, any danger in performance is like falling for the stereotype. And it's like what mattered to me most, I think, with Claire, it's like, for a while I was slightly paranoid about the accent. It's like, don't be, because that'll just get in the way of you being in the scene, like, emotionally and sitting with the reality of the situation. So, yeah, I mean, I countlessly rehearsed lines and all the rest of it, but ultimately you just have to do the technical practice and then trust the moment. Which I would say for singing, as a jazz singer, that's my approach with it. It's like, you learn it and you honour what it is that's written, and then in the moment you're like, all right, I'm going to let go of the technique and see what arrives.
See what happens.
Is that a good metaphor?
Yes, of course. Just play jazz.
So obviously there was only two series, so you kind of left Claire there. Moving forward with the rest of your career and stuff that you've done, have you ever found yourself taking elements of Claire and putting her in your real life?
In my real life,
other, I think whatever other works.
We live through, we kind of take elements of what we learn. I'd say, like, what I appreciate that I learned doing that job, like, not just the character of Claire, but the whole setup of it. It's like, for me, I think arts in its best form, like life in its best form, is like shipbuilding. As in, like, it's only the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
So there was something really special, I think, about that particular team of people, like behind and in front of the camera. Yeah. Like Gorgeous Georges was amazing. He was like camera, and the art department were amazing. And so there is something about really just making sure you've got the right people around you in order to make it easy.
Yeah.
Because life isn't easy and making work isn't always easy. But if you have the right people, at least you're like, our eyes were all on the work. There wasn't a great deal of like ego bashing or whatever. It's just like, no, we care about this and let's tell these stories.
Yeah.
So I would say I hope and like to think like I've taken that philosophy into my world and my life and lived it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
what I've learned from Claire, I guess, to honour, to sit outside of shame as a single mother has been one of my journeys also. Because I think, but it's still very recent that people... When I was pregnant, they're like, "Oh, is your husband excited or whatever?" And you're like, "Nope." So there's something I don't have one, so I haven't met him yet. He might be excited about something utterly unrelated at the minute. But there's a lot of that we can assume like judgment about people. And I think the beauty of John's writing and of High Times, it's like everybody's human, and there's mm-hmm. There's not a goodie or a baddie particularly. There's just folk living their lives with their internal conflicts. Mm-hmm. And I think we sit with our own goodies and baddies within us, don't we? And I think that's one of the beauties of it. It's like we've not othered the bad guy or embodied the good person. And there's a lot in the world at the minute, particularly in terms of looking at nuance and complexity. And I think that's what High Times does well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a genius show with genius writing and really, really well acted. You feel like the key with something like that is to make it feel like real people. Because when you watch something like EastEnders, it just feels like a total disconnect. People don't talk to each other the way they would in real life and stuff like that. And that's where High Times really gets it right. John's dialogue is so natural. And that's... I think that's what got it for me. I mean, just down to wee moments, like one moment for me was, it was actually when you came in drunk and Jimmy was supposed to have been at rehearsal. It's probably more of a role reversal for me. It'd be me showing up drunk and the wife getting pissed off, but it was just such a kind of real moment, a real conversation. But you were brilliant at that as well. See when he was like, it was meant to be at a rehearsal, and you're just like, oops.
I do remember like my back on the wall and that. Anyway, I'm a nice time.
Yeah. Why didn't you phone me? Your phone was off.
So it's something that, I mean, I'm going to watch it again and again and again. It's one of these ones. It's also layered, so you spot things you didn't see the first eight mm-hmm. times you watched it.
So true. Yeah.
And I think in defense of, like, I've never been EastEnders, but or I have been in River City, but going back to what we're saying about rehearsals, there is something to be said for funding the arts. The yeah. more money that we've got, though, the more that you can really invest in the detail of it. I guess mm-hmm. something like EastEnders, folk are going to watch it anyway. And there's a particular tone to that show that, because the actors won't get to rehearse, I'm sure yeah. they'll probably be running like 10 scripts at the same time. And the same, like, a friend that worked on Casualty, and that was the situation there. Like, we as much as possible could almost film chronologically, or that's, I put notes at the top of every scene. It's like, this has just happened. Right. Because I think when you are filming out of sequence, it is mm-hmm. hard to stay on top of, well, do we know, do you know that he's the dad? Am I with him? Do I fancy him? Have we met yet? Mm-hmm. So one of the beauties, I think, of High Times was there was a tenderness around that detail. And so I think, yeah, when it is a show that churns out episode after episode, it's tough on the writers and it's tough on the directors and it's tough on the actors. There's something also, I think, culturally in terms of taking time and pausing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our culture, it is about a very particular type of push, and the more that you produce, the better it is. And I would argue that that's like, if High Times is only ever two series, it was given the time and space that it needed to be what it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think if we were going to do it again, it kind of needs to be honored and held in that same way.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I suppose, like, you've got, if you have John Rooney at the front of it, and Davy Mackay and Caroline Kidd and all the gang, I mean, it would just be, again, like I said, it'd be that band getting back together. And I would imagine you would all instantly feel that connection again and recreate yeah. that magic.
Yeah. And James was the other director and Justin was the other director. Mm-hmm. I think yep. Justin and Stephen went on to... I noticed, I really loved Merlin. I've said it out loud, but I did
actually
love it. Good. Even it appeared in it once. I was like, And then I saw, Justin's name rolling in the credits. So it is funny, like, the ways in which, like, that was a nugget, but that everybody's lives kind of, mm-hmm. you know, Alison and yeah. I put together again. I see John regularly whenever I get me here. Like, there are other relationships that have been born from that nugget also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's, yeah. It's fun. I mean, you get to know who you like to work with, and it's if you get to choose who you work with on loads of different jobs, I can't think of anything better. I mean, I know that Justin and Stephen did Crying with Laughter, which I loved. If you, oh my goodness. You can get it on DVD. You can. I've got it somewhere.
We're doing Amazon.
Not 80 quid.
But it's not an easy film to watch. It's a tough watch, but it's bloody good. It's really well written and obviously well acted. And what's his, Malcolm, who was in High Times as well. He was the cop that was speaking to Eddie.
Yeah, he's a dancer by trade. Also, he used to work with a friend of mine, Jane Simpson. Is it an incredible physical performer? I worked like once upon a time at the Citizens Theatre in Glasgow. Saw him in something. He was amazing.
Yeah, he's very dark in that film.
It's
definitely one to watch. And obviously, that, like I said, that was Stephen and Justin as well. And they obviously have got a real fondness for each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's nice to see.
Aye, absolutely. So you would definitely consider a season three then, and you think you could get back into Claire's. There's another question for you. How would you even approach going back into Claire? I mean, you've moved on, you've grown up, your voice is completely different. Do you think it would be quite easy to just jump back into the character of Claire?
What I would definitely do would be watch the first two series like a number of times. And then, yeah, I mean, my voice probably sounded like this before and after High Times. <Right. laughs> First time you've heard me speaking out of
Yeah, that. Absolutely. Absolutely. I was like,
so it's, I've not had a kind of particular 15 year graduation away from Claire.
I suppose.
Yeah, I'm sure I could. If that was the biggest hurdle, I would definitely get over it.
Oh, good.
I'm sure there's more hurdles to deal with, but
we'll try.
Jumping soon. We'll start jumping soon. See that? Yes.
He got there. You've been terrific. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Judith.
Yep.
Where can everybody find you on? Well, they can find you on social media. It's Judith A. Williams on Facebook, right?
I'm not sure what I am on Facebook. I've got a website which is www.judithwilliams.me/hello, and the only reason it's .me is because there's a makeup artist and we share the same name and she's got all the domain names.
I noticed that, yeah, because I googled you last week at some point and it's like, who the fuck's that? Yeah.
She has changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I imagine
I came on, I was like, so I see you've got a makeup line.
That's the
type of thing I would do, by the way. I've put my foot in my mouth so many times on this. I'm really surprised that I haven't done it more on this series.
God damn. Yeah, I'll make sure to put your links in the description and I'll get everybody that's listening to the show to go ahead and follow you. It'd be unbelievable if the stars were to align and season three could go ahead. I know that both of us will certainly do everything in our power. And I believe that power comes in all different shapes and sizes. So we, being the little guys, can still make it happen, make a big difference like the lion and the mouse. So we'll definitely try our best.
A group of committed people can change the world.
That's so true.
The only thing that ever has.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Love it. And I've got a cinema camera, so I can film it.
John and hide a flat. We do it.
Just don't call it High Times. Call it Higher Times.
Higher Times.
Right, or Lower Times if it's not in a flat. We have the resources so we can.
Capacity to remain flexible.
Exactly.
Imagine that low Times and they all live in the same bungalow. It's a weird concept.
Absolutely.
That's an art house film, that one.
Of course. So thanks again, Judith. You've been an absolute pleasure. I can't believe I'm sitting talking to Claire on a podcast. I mean, big huge thanks to Steve McCall for giving you guys a shout and making this, you know, bridging the gap for us all to kind of chat and put our put it out there in the universe.
My pleasure. Lovely to meet you both on this strange platform. And I look forward to Bathgate reunited.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks very much for me as well. It's been a blast.
Total pleasure. If you need anything else, just give us a shout.
Oh, hey, you'll regret saying that. Huge pleasure to speak to Judith. It was really nice for her to give us her time. And I feel blessed. I am very graceful. You know, gratitude for that.
That's us. We're four episodes deep now into this series, and every one of them's feeling like a privilege. So,
hey, you're telling me.
Keep on listening, and we'll keep on delivering. And,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, to be fair, we're just here. Those guys are the ones that are delivering.
We ask questions. We're good at that.
I don't know. I think the answers are better than the questions, mainly.
Obviously, I'm just trying to make myself feel better.
Nah, of course. It's an absolute pleasure. I can't believe these guys are actually giving us the time of day because we're so minute on the scale of how successful they are. And, you know, their time's probably taken up by many things. So it's, you know, it's really, really appreciated that all these guys are giving us their time. So huge thanks to them. Guys, go and show them some love on social media. You can also find all of Judith's links in the description here, wherever you're listening, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere that you're listening. Just check the description, follow the links and see what these incredibly talented people are up to. And make sure you do subscribe to this podcast if you'd like to hear the upcoming episodes where we'll be speaking to the rest of the cast. And just kind of go show some love to High Times that you can find on the STV player. It might be on YouTube, but we recommend watching it on STV player because I think that's probably the right way to watch it.
It certainly is. Just fucking endure the adverts, all right?
Exactly. Because wait a minute. Do the cast make coin on the adverts? Probably not.
I'm not even going to ask.
Watch it on YouTube.
Don't. STV player, let's keep this legal.
So the next episode that you guys will hear will be with John Morrison. He plays Eddie.
That's it. I thought you were going to get there.
It was a dramatic pause. Thanks, J-Mac. You don't appreciate art. No metaphors. Bring Judith back on.
Kevin, I'm hurt. I cannot... I don't appreciate art. What do you call that? I've been scribbling. that when I'm dead, that's going to be worth less.
Absolutely. So, guys, tune in next time, and we will be speaking to John Morrison, and let's keep this High Times train rolling. I, as always, I'm Kevin Wells. Him over there, he's who?
J-Mac this time.
Every time. Thanks again for tuning in, guys. We love you all. Have a nice evening, weekend, /day, wherever, whatever you are.
Catch you on the flip side.
Gotta be careful when you come upon smiling faces. Gonna take you places you've never been before.